Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, September 4th, 2015. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And for a reason I'll explain in a moment, I use that term lightly on the countdown this week. My first expert is David Olive of Catalyst Partners, return attendee on the countdown. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks
great
for coming
to be
in.
Here, Francis.
I hope you have a terrific Labor Day weekend. And I meant I cast no aspersions on you and your expertise in the federal government when I said that, because the other person on the countdown this week is
a true expert.
No, you're stuck with me. It's the weekend before Labor Day. And I'm very grateful that you're in town, although I can't figure out for the life of me why you are.
Well, certainly there's the opportunity to be with an expert on federal government.
I don't believe
business politics.
I don't believe that for a minute. But anyway, you're here, and I'm very glad you are, and you have made terrific selections, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And we start where we always do with
number three.
And David, your choice is from the Federal Times. The headline is, "Sorry, Fed's top cyber talent may be ineligible for you." And I thought this story was particularly interesting and instructive in light of the whole controversy about the SF-86s that have been stolen from the Office of Personnel Management, all of the concern and care about the information that was included therein. And it turns out that that's the kind of information that might be disqualifying for the very kinds of cyber professionals that we want to attract in government.
Well, the story appealed to me for two reasons. And first, it's not a news story. It's one that we've heard a lot. So I was thinking you were going to say, so David, why did you pick this one? We've talked about it on this radio station forever. But when you tie it with the SF-86, the OPM hack, as well as my number two story, I think it takes on very great significance this week. Plus, to put it in context, I spent a significant amount of time out at the ICE Cyber Crime Center. And those guys are doing tremendous work. But story after story that I heard about their onboarding process and what's disqualifying people, because if you work at DHS, it's not just the security background. There's the suitability review that they have to do as well. One story I heard was that a student applied, not at ICE, but at the FBI for a cyber analyst job and went through the test, said, yes, we'd have to do all the background stuff. We will be in touch with you. 27 months later, they called him and said, we're ready for you to report to Quantico.
And he'd had at least one other job in the meantime.
He had two other jobs, yep. A wife and a small kid. And so they lost talent, really first-rate talent of people who want to be part of the mission because of the problems in getting them on board. What struck me about this story is Tony Scott, who I think is doing a magnificent job, talked about the problems both in people's backgrounds and in the process itself. And there is a huge need for cyber talent, and we just don't have the ability to keep up because the bad guys don't have those same hurdles.
One such potential employee who applied for a job with the FBI in 2010 said she believed she was denied the position after admitting to participating in file sharing, downloading copyrighted music and videos in the past. Now, that's what she thinks. We don't know that that's the case.
Correct.
But as I think about the stringent requirements that exist, it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility. And just that is a little bit concerning.
I dare say that at one point in time, probably upwards of 75-80% of all college students were downloading from Napster or some of the other file sharing services. And we're probably not thinking of the consequences down the road. Same thing is true now of the students who are entering college and starting back to school this week and next week. What are they posting on social media that's going to be out there to be retrieved? And what should the government standards be in terms of hiring? Because if we put handcuffs on our ability to get talented people who can help us, and maybe we need some people who know how to manipulate the system in order to be kind of the white hat hackers, If we put handcuffs on those, then we're not going to have the talent we need, and we'll have more OPM breaches, and that won't be good for us.
David Olive's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week from the Federal Times. Sorry, feds, top cyber talent might be ineligible for you. My choice at number three this week is from federalnewsradio.com. It's my new colleague Scott Moncione's column, story, Five Ways to Transform VA Healthcare. David Shulkin is now 2 months into his job as the Undersecretary for Health at VA. And I'm struck, David, by not just my this story about Mr. Shulkin, but also my colleague Emily Kopp's conversation with Tom Allen, who's the new Chief Veterans Experience Administrator at the Department of Veterans Affairs, how nobody there, including Secretary Gibson and Secretary McDonald, seems to be shrinking from the 17-month now deadline that they have to try to get things accomplished. Nobody's coasting. And I think that's a really good sign to send to the rest of the people in the organization.
I thought it was fascinating to hear Allen's interview that Emily did, where he said the thing that appealed to him most is every sentence VA used in talking to him started with the word customer.
Mm-hmm.
That is a sea change in the culture, both internally and from the perception of the culture. There's still massive problems, but if there's momentum moving in a positive direction, and clearly this story and Emily's stories indicate it, then that's a huge thing. Plus, I think earlier this week someone interviewed here the person who runs veterans health care benefits that have reduced their backlog tremendously. So there are some positive things going, and they're not going to slow down just because they're in a lame duck.
That's my colleague Tom Temin's conversation with Allison Hickey, the Undersecretary for Benefits at VA. Terrific conversation that's archived at federalnewsradio.com/federal drive. And I hear that word, customer, more and more and more now than I ever have before. And I think that's nothing but a good thing to focus that way. And one of the things I think is really good about the way Secretary McDonald is approaching this is he seems to have acquired in the year or more that he's been on the job an understanding of the history of VA. And he recognized, he spoke at an event at Politico a couple of weeks ago that I thought was very well done on his part. And he talked about the need to shift the VA culture from serving VA to serving the veteran. And I thought that was a very astute observation of where VA was and where he wants it to go.
Yeah, one of the things I think you will hear when you're talking to people within the VA or that work within their system is that their language has changed, not simply because of the top-down dictate, you have to change the way you refer to things, but it is actually being built into everything that they do. So when you talk to Greg Giddens in acquisition, or you talk to the people that are certifying veteran businesses, which has to be done on an independent basis, it's not a self-certification, they're all about serving veterans. And you will never hear them say, well, that's not the way we do things.
Mm-hmm.
That's a positive development.
We have yet to see that trickle down. We still are seeing stories about issues that are happening out in the field. That strikes me, though, as a matter of time, and identifying people in further down in the chain that are willing to take on this same goal and think about it in the same way and kind of make it permeate through the middle part of the organization. You think that's an accurate read?
Oh, yeah, I think they're turning a big battleship or a series of battleships around, so that's true. My cynical thought on the Friday before Labor Day is that if Congress were to try to make the customer service focus changes that VA is making, we would be in a very different environment.
You are cynical on a Friday before Labor Day, David?
Shocking.
It is. All right. The third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com, according to me at least, and it is headlined, Five Ways to Transform VA Healthcare. You can find that story and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week. The Federal News Countdown continues with me and David Olive next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by myself and David Olive, and we are up to
number two.
David, your choice is the second most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post. The headline is U.S. developing sanctions against China over cyber thefts. And this is something that people have been asking about for a long time. What are we going to do about the cyber attacks that have taken place? The OPM hack was probably the most recent high-profile case. Certainly not the only case that's been attributed to China. Many others have been. What's your takeaway from the idea of sanctioning China when they're such a big trade partner for us and hold so much of our debt?
That's what made this story of significance to me, is that the administration, with the pending visit of the Chinese prime minister, is talking about economic sanctions targeted at Chinese exfiltration of economic information. What was interesting in this story also, for the first time that I have seen at least, it says that the sanctions being considered are not in retaliation for the OPM hack, because those were judged as carried out for traditional intelligence purposes, not benefiting Chinese industry. Now, I know General Hayden has said that that's how he viewed it, but it's really the first time somebody in the administration has come out publicly that I have heard and said that what we're doing is we're going after the Chinese who are taking our intellectual property, who are stealing plans from military assets, mm-hmm. Not so much for the OPM hack, but they're doing it on the eve of the visit, which I think is posturing and sending a signal that maybe we're fed up with it, and maybe this is the White House way of addressing the what are we going to do. The story also says that the OPM hack didn't cause the sanctions, but it certainly created the atmosphere that makes those sanctions or the sanctions discussion possible. What does that mean? Are we ready for the second and third order effects if we impose sanctions? Nobody knows. And that is also mentioned as to would we should expect some type of response, but no one knows what that would be.
It's a really fascinating dynamic right now regarding our relationship with China, because they're, of course, suffering from a very high level of economic fragility. Their stock market's a disaster right now, and that is happening primarily because people believe that their economic growth numbers have been faked for a long, long time,
right.
And that's now starting to catch up with them. The numbers that they're saying are lower than the numbers they've been saying for a while that nobody believed. So if they've been overstating by 3-5% historically, they're now getting close to negative economic growth. So if they're going into a recession at the same time that we're potentially imposing sanctions, and we're not sure about the activities that they're conducting in the South China Sea, this really turns into a big stew of stuff that's going on at the same time that we're deciding to implement these sanctions.
I think you also add to that the announcement this week that the Chinese were going to downsize their military,
yeah,
by some 300,000 individuals, and the stories about that say that it is because they need to change their old Soviet era way of military response and command control to go more towards technology, the cyber side of protection. So marry this with China is building up their cybersecurity capabilities even more than they already have. The fact that the U.S. response may be to try to impose some economic sanctions, which may have second, third order effects on both economies. We don't know what the real story is on theirs. And we're having trouble hiring the kind of cybersecurity talent that they seem to now be developing. It is a real Rubik's Cube of problems.
Another wrinkle in this, David, is the idea that the Chinese government is starting to suffer from a problem that we're looking at. When you mentioned just a moment ago the downsizing of the military, they're going to have 300,000 people leaving the military and have to figure out what to do with them. and they certainly run their economy dramatically different than we do.
Right.
And so it will be a case of essentially ordering 300,000 people to a variety of positions, jobs around the country, because those 300,000 people aren't just allowed to do what they are here, which is to go out and do whatever job appeals to them, and they have the skills to be able to execute.
Sure. So, I think you've got this combination or confluence of all these problems coming together just as the two leaders of China and the U.S. get together. It should be a fascinating discussion.
David Olive's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post: U.S. developing sanctions against China over cyber thefts. My choice at number two this week is from federalnewsradio.com: contract for cybersecurity awarded by federal agencies. We mentioned the OPM cyber breach a few minutes ago, and one of the reasons that I chose this story, David, is because it appears to me, at least, that OPM and the federal government learned lessons quickly from the response to the first breach and are taking the desires, customer service again, of the federal employees that were affected by this into account and changing the way that they're going to respond to provide a response to the second breach where the SF-86s were taken.
I thought the other thing in that story that was fascinating is they also listened to the problems other people had in knowing whether to even open an email or whether it was some sort of malware phishing exercise, so that all the notices will come from a DOD address instead of a .com address or to a private contractor. So somebody over there is paying attention.
Yeah. The contract went to a company called ID Experts, but that's only for the identity protection.
Right.
The Defense Department will do the notification and will point people to how to communicate with ID Experts and get the identity protection services. The protection services will also be available to the dependents of people that were affected by this as part of an effort to try to help people whose information may have been compromised, who never had anything to do with the federal government except being close to somebody personally, sufficiently close that they were named on a form and their information was also included in the database.
And included in that group is not just the object of the investigation or the family members. It's also people who gave references, because I'm sure you and I both show up as references to a number of people in addition to probably having a file. So.
Yep. That's exactly right. That was my first thought when the second breach happened was, well, this one doesn't affect me either. And as we learn more about it later the same day, actually, I thought, oh, maybe I am in there because of the exact reason that you just mentioned.
Right. So they're paying attention. They're going out. They've also not put an endpoint on the families that are protected. They're saying, we'll cover children, and if grandchildren were mentioned or they're alive, then we're going to, you know, we'll cover them if a claim should come up. Now, they're not extending this into perpetuity for the entire United States population, but they are reaching out to, they've heard the concerns and they're reaching out to solve them.
We just have about a minute left. The other thing that I saw discussed around this story that I thought was interesting is, the debate and discussion will continue in Congress as to whether federal employees should have some kind of identity protection as an ongoing benefit, as assuming that people will continue to try to break into federal networks and steal information about federal employees. And as a result of that, should federal employees be covered all the time? And I wouldn't be surprised to start to see that offered as a benefit in private sector companies either.
Chairman Mike McCaul, House Homeland Security Committee, says he's going to introduce his new cyber information sharing liability protection bill when they come back in the next week. Hopes to get it on the floor and out before the end of the year. I would not be surprised to see that as the vehicle. It's probably too late for the Senate CISA bill that they'll vote on within the next 10 days after the Iranian vote goes. But I think you'll see that, and I don't think there'll be any significant opposition from either side.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as I've selected, is from federalnewsradio.com, contract for cybersecurity awarded by federal agencies. And you can read that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. This week selected by me and by David Olive, and we're up to...
Number one!
And David, your choice is number one is from the New York Times. Coordinated strategy brings Obama victory on Iran nuclear deal. And I'm not as interested in the political machinations that are going on here that are very well covered in other outlets. I'm interested in what has to happen if and when this deal passes and is approved by Congress. What has to happen operationally in order for this to work? Because it appears to have a lot of complexities and so on that we're learning about through the political process.
What made this story stand out from the others for me was not only the approach that the White House and Nancy Pelosi and her office took, but the fact that they relied upon subject matter experts like the cabinet secretary with the greatest hair in Washington, Ernie Moritz, and they brought in representatives from foreign governments who carried a lot more credibility than even our own State Department about what the practical implications of the agreement would be and how tough it would be. Just this morning, since we had to submit the stories yesterday, just this morning, the Secretary of Defense has an op-ed in USA Today talking about how this does nothing to affect the military's role and what they will be doing to monitor it and respond as appropriate. There's stories about the Saudi king who's coming to visit with the president and who had 4 months ago canceled his plans because of the Iranian deal, where they've now worked on him. And Saudi will be getting apparently new monitoring equipment and new response equipment. So those things are working themselves out. It is incredibly complicated. But the fact that the president got the number of votes he needed, even in light of Chuck Schumer, the incoming, you know, Democratic leader in the Senate, saying he would vote against the deal, means, you know, not only the politics of it are now kind of out of the way without any retribution to individuals, but they can focus on some of those compliance details. And I think that's what the debate will be about next week, whether the Republicans believe that they can adequately monitor it and what happens when the 15-year deal is done versus what we would have if we did not have an agreement.
I'm struck by some of the people who are coming out in support of this deal, some of them publicly and very loudly, some of them privately, some of them publicly but very quietly, who don't really speak up, but when they ask, are asked, endorse it. One of those is Ryan Crocker.
Right.
Ambassador Crocker did an interview with him for a project a couple of weeks ago, and he almost talked about it in a very offhand way in the context of some other issues around the world that he and I were discussing, and said, and something kind of, and if the Iran deal would be unfortunately taken down by the Republican Congress, and then on with completed the rest of his thought. And I thought, wait a minute, you just said something really important there, Mr. Ambassador. I'm struck by those kinds of people that are talking about this deal in that context.
The as you know, Ambassador Crocker has a lot of attributes, but shyness is not one of them. And even though he's a career diplomat, there are times that he is able to speak very directly. I heard him speak out at Aspen, the Security Forum, on the subject. And it was almost the same thing, that we've got a framework we can work with the Iranians. We can hold them accountable to it. Our biggest problem is in Syria and what to do in Syria and how we're responding and what the international issues are. And we have no good answers for that problem. And he just kind of glossed over, you know, the Iranian deal, I think, because they believe that was the best deal they could strike and move down the road.
And you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation about this story, David, that that was the effort that Leader Pelosi undertook on the Democratic side in the House. This story in the New York Times says a dozen or so undecided Democrats met in the Capitol with senior diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, who delivered a blunt joint message. Their nuclear agreement with Iran was the best they could expect. The five world powers had no intention of returning to the negotiating table. Now, you were cynical a few minutes ago. I'll be cynical again. It's my turn. I'm cynical about China and Russia returning, saying they won't return to the negotiating table. Of course they won't. They have no desire to negotiate against, theoretically, their ally. The Britain, France, Germany triumvirate's a little different because as we see what's going on politically with all of the migrants that are leaving the Middle East and trying to navigate their way to those three countries, those are the three primary countries along with Italy and Turkey where migrants from the Middle East are trying to get in. One would think that if those three countries at least thought there was a better deal to be had, they'd be willing to go back to the table. So the three of them saying there's not, I find a tremendous amount of meaning in.
The sentence or the paragraph right after the one you read is from Senator Coons from Delaware, who says that what impressed him the most is all five of them were unanimous and they were not going to reimpose sanctions irrespective of what the United States did. So what struck me on the levels of complexity, China and Russia, Russia against whom we currently have economic sanctions, China, who we're talking about imposing cybersecurity sanctions, are trotted up to Capitol Hill to sell the deal along with the three countries most impacted by the refugee problem, the heart-rending pictures that we saw this week of the children washed up on the beach, you know, just creating an international outrage. But no one is talking about what to do to fix it. And one thinks that, you know, somewhere behind that, they believe if we can get a deal with the Iranians, that the Iranians will step in and help solve some of this refugee problem. That may be wishful thinking on their part, but there was a reason those five countries were picked to the exclusion of others. Very, very telling.
It's an interesting story, and it is archived along with all of our Federal News Countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. David Olive's choice is number one this week from the New York Times. Coordinated strategy brings Obama victory on Iran nuclear deal, and you can read that and all of our stories on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week, according to me, on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. David Olive choosing them along with me this week. And my choice at number one is my colleague Nicole DeGrisco's story, headlined Federal Shutdown Would Put Offensive Pressure on DOD. Bob Hale has put together a terrific conversation, or a terrific paper, which is, David, part memoir almost and part opinion and commentary on what's going on in Congress right now and how it would impact the Department of Defense based on his time serving as Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller at DOD. He was on the program this week talking about it, and then the Brookings Institution rolled his piece out this week. And although Nicole did a terrific job, I think, of describing Bob's comments both on the program and at the Brookings event, what really jumped out at me is the comments by Don Beyer, congressman from Virginia, a Democrat, represents a ton of federal employees. He's in Jim Moran's old district. Jerry's in Kansas. And not in the House of Representatives anymore. Jim Moran's old district in Northern Virginia. And Congressman Beyer says, I don't see us getting a budget by September 30th. That part's no surprise to anybody, I don't think. Is that fair to say?
I think it's absolutely conventional wisdom.
Okay, so this is where Congressman Beyer goes, though, that's relatively new to me, I think. This is a quote. Most people on the Hill anticipate something like the cromnibus of last December happening again this December, just before we adjourn before the holidays. Now, you're on the Hill all the time, not necessarily talking to folks about the budget, but I imagine that that permeates the discussions that you're talking about in other areas. If is that a reasonable assumption on my part?
About 2 months ago, Hal Rogers, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, did a Bloomberg breakfast, and he was asked, what are you going to do if we don't get a FY16 budget? And his comment at the time was, I suspect we'll do a CR up until December, and then we'll figure out what to do for the rest of the year, somewhat the way they did with the Department of Homeland Security's budget this past year.
Mm-hmm.
There were audible moans and groans in the audience. But what we are hearing, at least among the staff, because members don't come back until next week, is that they may not even be able to get a deal that ends, a CR that ends in December. They may have a full year CR. And if that were the case, it would create serious problems. So I think Secretary Hale is right, not only to include logical solutions and pointing out the issues, but to, as he did at Brookings, to provide at least a couple of the real-world impacts.
Mm-hmm.
Prince, the problem I have with is that it's a perfectly logical response in a perfectly political climate, and those two are not necessarily the same.
Secretary Hale wrote, DOD can hold its financial breath for a couple of months under a clean classic CR, but if you extend to that to 6 months, and especially if you thought of extending that to a year, serious problems would result. It would be very ineffective. And he talked about some of the reasons why that would be the case. And you can hear my conversation with Bob Hale at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. But I think it would be very useful for the members of the administration, where appropriate, to start sending the same message that Bob Hale is sending, because we haven't really heard that from the administration, from the executive branch that much yet.
No, that's true. And they've had other matters on their plate,
sure,
that they didn't want to water down their message. What makes Congressman Beyer's comments all the more fascinating to me is that he is both a former state official and a very well-known business person, in addition to representing the congressional district with a lot of federal activity. So he comes at this from an operational impact point of view, and there are very serious operational impacts that come into play. DOD clearly has the most pressure on it, but if we have a continuing CR for the year, it affects everyone. Just one to think about is what they do with Homeland Security's Secret Service budget in a presidential election year where the Secret Service needs to ramp up the protection capabilities that they have, and how they work their way around that issue. And that's just one of multiple problems that mm-hmm. we have that a CR and sequestration bring.
And we also would expect to start seeing some budgetary preparations for a transition in 2017 under a CR. None of that, because I'm not aware of money that was hidden anywhere in the budget in fiscal 15 for transition operations.
There was a small amount just to simply set up an office.
Stand the office.
One of the stories I saw is that they were actually going to be headquartered in the GSA building down on down on E Street. F Street.
18th and F.
Yeah.
The bottom line, we only have about a minute left, but do we have a sense yet of whether we'll see anything this coming week? Congress is back on Monday, or Tuesday, after the Labor Day holiday. But my sense is that all of this Iran conversation, as we talked about in the last part of the countdown, is probably going to suck the oxygen out of the room for the first several days. They've only got 10 business days.
The real stumbling block on the appropriations bill will be how Congress deals with Planned Parenthood. the Republicans and the conservatives are outraged at the videos that have been released. Mitch McConnell came out this week and said that Planned Parenthood would not derail the budget. We will see if he has the votes.
He's not the. I was going to say he's not the only one that gets to pick.
Sure, but there are only 10 days left unless they decide to hold him in over the weekends, and that's not uncommon.
The most important federal news story of the week, my choice this week, is from federalnewsradio.com. Federal shutdown would put offensive pressure on DOD. That story and all of the countdown stories are at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. David Olive of Catalyst Partners, great to see you, my friend.
Great to see you, Francis. Have a happy Labor Day, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, and thanks for doing it. The Federal News Countdown archived at federalnewsradio.com.